is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The cryptocurrency Bitcoin reached a high of $50,000 for the first time last week. This comes as Tesla, MasterCard, and China are all making big moves into the crypto and digital currency space. This has many global economists wondering, is this a canary in the coal mine moment? Does Bitcoin's rise reflect a decline of the U.S. dollar's global influence? We're going to dive into this question in just a moment, but first, we want to take a moment to acknowledge that a lot of us still don't fully understand exactly what Bitcoin actually is. So think of Bitcoin as digital cash. Digital cash is like me being able to email you a $100 bill from my wallet. No banks, no transaction fees, no paperwork.
Yay!
People have been trying to create digital cash since the 1970s, but they couldn't solve the double spend problem. What is the double spend problem? Well, it's simple. If I give you a physical $100 bill, I can no longer spend that $100 bill. Only one person can have that $100 bill. In the digital world, this is much more complex. If I send you an MP3 of my favorite song, it's like rain, yeah. You now have that MP3. And I also have that MP3. There's nothing to prevent you and me from both having it. It's the same with digital cash, and that's a problem. But in 2008, an anonymous person using the name Satoshi Nakamoto cracked the double spend problem and created Bitcoin. How did Nakamoto do this? The answer is blockchain. In traditional financial transactions, the bank or, say, Venmo, serve as a middleman. Middlemen prevent the double spend problem by keeping track of who has that $100 and who has the Beanie Babies I bought with that $100. The middleman records that transaction on a centralized ledger controlled by them. And then they communicate with all the other banks and middlemen to coordinate the transactions on their ledgers. Blockchain removes the need for a middleman and creates peer-to-peer digital cash transfers, just like exchanging a physical $100 bill. Here's the tricky bit. It does this by using a distributed ledger. Every single transaction is posted out in the open across millions of computers for anyone to see. Everybody who owns Bitcoin sees the same ledger and every single change to that ledger. So if I give you $100 in Bitcoin, that transaction is recorded on the distributed ledger for everyone to see, so I can no longer spend that $100. I can't hack the blockchain either, because I'd have to hack millions of computers at the exact same time. This is how Don Tapscott of the Blockchain Research Institute explains it, as lampooned by comedian John Oliver.
The way I like to think of it is that a blockchain is a highly processed thing, sort of like a chicken McNugget. And if you wanted to hack it, it'd be like turning a chicken McNugget back into a chicken. Now, someday someone will be able to do that, but for now, it's going to be tough.
Hold on. That is an absolutely horrible thought.
Okay, it's kind of gross. And that, in a nutshell, is the basics of how Bitcoin works. Okay. We've got the basics, so let's get into the discussion about the future of digital money. Joining me now to help us understand all this is Rana Faruhar. She's a global business columnist with the Financial Times. Welcome back, Rana.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Peter Van Valkenburg. He's director of research at Coin Center. That's a DC-based think tank that studies cryptocurrencies. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Peter, how did we do with that explanation? Was that pretty accurate?
That was spot on. One of the best ones I've heard from a major news outlet. So kudos.
Well, the price.
I love the sound effects.
Oh, great! Great. I will pass it on to the producer. The price of Bitcoin dropped below $50,000 this morning. So, but clarify exactly what you're buying with that roughly $50,000 when you buy Bitcoin. Is it a single coin? Can I buy a fraction of a Bitcoin?
Sure. So you can absolutely buy a fraction of a Bitcoin. And in fact, the community was so intent on making everyone understand that, that I think there's a bunch of t-shirts that say you can buy a fraction of a Bitcoin, because obviously one is now pretty expensive. What you're buying is is basically either one or some fraction of these units that are described on that blockchain that you described in the opening. And, you know, that blockchain is difficult to alter or difficult to forge, extremely difficult, like turning a chicken nugget back into a chicken. And so you are basically claiming one of a finite number of Bitcoins described by that ledger. And, you know, because it's scarce, because there's a finite number of them, if there's positive market demand for them, the laws of supply and demand say that there will be a price. Now, that price is going to change as demand fluctuates. So fewer people seem to want Bitcoin today as a couple days ago, and that's why the price went down. But I think, you know, we can expect a certain amount of stability given that the supply never changes.
Rana, help us understand the relationship between the U.S. dollar and cryptocurrency like Bitcoin. Is it like exchanging dollars for euros?
Well, you know, I actually would pull the lens way back and look at this less in a technical sense and more in a kind of a political economy sense. You think about, what is money? You know, money, the U.S. dollar is currency that is underwritten by the central bank, by the Fed. The euro is underwritten by the European Central Bank. The Chinese government underwrites the RMB. So each nation, you know, or region has a currency, and there's a kind of a trust built into it that's built on trust in that government and in that country. And to me, one of the reasons for the rise of cryptocurrency is not just because it's well suited in many ways to an increasingly digital, globally connected economy, but it also has to do with a sense of possibly diminished trust, certainly amongst the financial community, in governments, in national governments. I mean, if you look back, you know, we've had the current monetary system for many decades now. We moved from a gold standard to a dollar standard. But in recent years, central banks, the Fed, have pumped a lot of money into the system. We've also had, you know, plenty of political problems at home, a lack of trust in the U.S. government. And so that has created a kind of a sense that, well, is the dollar really as trustworthy as a global currency as we thought? Now, some people say, oh, you know, there's no substitute. And that's true. There's no substitute in terms of a global reserve currency. It's not like the euro or the RMB are going to take over. But I see crypto as a kind of a creeping message, a little bit of a canary in the coal mine, as you said in the beginning of your program, to political changes that are happening.
Rana, how did the U.S. dollar become the global reserve currency in the first place?
Well, you know, the Bretton Woods system, you know, several decades ago, basically a lot of technocrats got together in a room and decided that the world was going to move from a gold standard to a dollar standard. And that was based on the post-war strength of America. It was based on the desire of a lot of powers that be in the world to kind of connect the planet and basically tampen down nationalism by getting everyone together in a dollar unified system. The world is changing. It's becoming more fragmented. You know, I think that the Washington consensus, which is essentially what set this dollar standard, is broken. We don't quite have a Beijing consensus. We kind of have a Facebook consensus, which is sort of, you know, the rise of digital technology, of platform power, and of cryptocurrency is all part of that.
Well, Tesla recently bought $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. MasterCard has also announced it will soon accept cryptocurrency payments on its networks. Peter, what does that signal to you about these digital currencies' place in the mainstream?
Well, so you describe the technology real well, and hopefully the central value proposition is obvious. Look, we've got a financial system that increasingly since the 1970s is predicated on reliance on a couple large, lumpy corporate banking institutions. And we have to trust them to do their job efficiently, and we have to trust them to not censor our transactions, not spy on our transactions. And I don't think anybody actually likes that arrangement. You can see what's going on in China with their central bank digital currency projects. You can look at Tesla investing in Bitcoin, and you can look at MasterCard, which is mostly talking about dealing with stable coins, which travel on top of the Bitcoin network or the Ethereum network and are dollar-backed, actually. The message here is that, you know, money is going digital and peer-to-peer. It's not going to be a thing that is all about bank balance sheets anymore. It's going to look a lot more like physical cash moving from person to person. And frankly, I think that's good for liberty, and it's also good for innovation and for efficiency, because we don't need these middlemen anymore.
Kenny tweets, I got into crypto in 2016 to try building college funds for my kiddos. Between the run in 2017 and 2018 and the current bull market, mission accomplished, and then some. And Michelle emails, a few years ago, we decided to accept Bitcoin at our restaurant, having been persuaded by a couple of sharp young men who were promoting Bitcoin in our small city. It was problematic tax-wise, and so we traded it to our son, who was a manager at the restaurant, dollar for dollar. His investment is now tens of thousands more than the initial amount. Well, we'll hear more from you and our guest after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
One of the premier science fiction writers of the 20th century, Octavia Butler imagined worlds that were radically different and strikingly similar to the one we live in today.
For our Black History Month special series, The Cautionary Tales and the Reasons for Hope that Octavia Butler left us.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to our conversation about Bitcoin with this Facebook message from Lisa. She writes, no one knows the future of Bitcoin, but my small investment has got me smiling every day. But Danny emails, Bitcoin has high volatility and risk. The market seems immersed in a speculative bubble. When it bursts, who will help families and investors? Should this market be more regulated by an international coalition of countries or multilateral institutions such as the World Bank? Rana, your thoughts?
Well, good luck with that. I mean, you know, I think one of the reasons that crypto is rising is that there's been so little collaboration between institutions for many years now. In an ideal world, I think that we would have, in a really ideal world, a digital currency that would be a basket currency that would help to balance out the dollar, the euro, the RMB. I mean, that would actually do a lot for helping to rebalance the global economy. And I think, you know, getting at something that the other guest was getting at, we have a world that's becoming in some ways more globally connected, but also fragmented in terms of needs. And so this idea of peer-to-peer connection and kind of creating some decentralization in the way currency flows is kind of what you want. The question is trust, really. Do you trust who you're dealing with on the other side of this transaction?
You write that there are three main geopolitical centers of power, China, the U.S., and Europe. I'm curious what you think this means for the future of the global financial system.
I think that we're moving to a world in which ultimately the dollar will not be the sole global reserve. I think it will stand alongside other currencies and cryptocurrency. Maybe one of those. Certainly, I think that the digital RMB is going to have a bigger role. I think that the euro may have a bigger role. I mean, currency is part of national power, and national power reflects, bigger political trends. Right now, we have a new great power conflict between the U.S. and China, and I think what's happening with currency reflects that.
Rana, how much regulation do you believe is appropriate for cryptocurrencies?
That's a great question. I mean, certainly as much as the traditional financial system has had now, you could argue whether the traditional financial system has had enough regulation. I mean, one of the problems I see, and again, I'm going to be a little more abstract, but I think it's important. Markets only work when there is really proper information sharing between two parties. That's always been a problem. I mean, I would argue that that's a huge problem in our traditional financial system. There's a lot of information asymmetry. Some people think that there's not enough understanding on the part of all the users as well as regulators about cryptocurrency. I would note that the Biden administration's nominee for SEC chair, Gary Gensler, who used to run CFTC, is actually an expert in these topics. He was up at MIT studying cryptocurrency. So I expect that that the Biden administration is going to be looking at this topic quite carefully. I would also note that I'm a little worried that some of the existing problems with asset inflation, vested interests in the financial system are going to be transferred into this new world of crypto in ways that are even harder to suss out. So in short, I think regulation is a big issue.
Peter, your organization, Coin Center, advocates for government to basically use a light touch when regulating cryptocurrency. Why is that?
Well, we actually specifically advocate for parity with existing financial institution regulation. And you might be surprised, and your listeners might be surprised to know that we've had parity for quite some time now. So since 2013, FinCEN, which is a division of Treasury that does anti-money laundering policy, sort of tracks down people using the financial channels for criminal monies, has said that if you're helping people buy Bitcoin, if you're helping people hold Bitcoin, if you're an exchange, as we currently call these things, you are a financial institution. You need to know your customers. You need to file suspicious activity reports. The fact of the matter is, since 2013, Bitcoin transactions are about as regulated as any normal financial transaction at a bank for anti-money laundering purposes. Since 2014, we've had states regulating these exchanges for consumer protection. They have to register as money transmitters, which means they need to post a bond, fingerprint their board of directors, go through a complex registration scheme 53 times over in all the states and territories that license exchanges. And so we've got consumer protection regulation akin to traditional financial institution regulation since 2014. Since 2016, we've had clarity on whether or not Bitcoin is classified as a security and therefore within the jurisdiction of the SEC. And you're right, Gary Gensler, who's going to be, it seems, the next SEC chair, is an expert in this technology. I've had several conversations with him about the underlying fundamentals of Ethereum and its technology that I've learned a lot from. So I think, you know, we're well positioned, and regulation should be reasonable. It should allow innovation to flourish. That's why, you know, the US was a home for the internet and the jobs and the technology growth that came out of the growth of the peer-to-peer internet. And the US should also be a welcoming home, you know, with guardrails in place for peer-to-peer finance, for Bitcoin, for Ethereum.
Go ahead, Rana.
If I could just build on that for a minute, there also doesn't have to be some kind of binary trade-off between traditional government-backed currency and cryptocurrency. I mean, if you look at what China is doing, they're actually rolling out a digital version of the RMB, which is their currency. One could imagine the U.S. government getting into the digital currency space, and, you know, you could also argue that that might be a good thing.
Rana, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Bye-bye.
We're discussing cryptocurrencies and how they're shaking up the tech sector. We'll have more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do. At a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capital Gazette.
Now let's get back to cryptocurrency. And Peter, I've got to say, we're getting a lot of questions about the energy used in Bitcoin and not so encrypted tweets. Please make sure to talk about how much energy is used in mining Bitcoin and managing its transactions. It is completely unconscionable to be using a currency that contributes so directly to the dire emergency that is climate crisis. And we should mention here, Cambridge researchers say Bitcoin uses more electricity than the country of Argentina. And if it was a country, it would be in the top 30 energy users worldwide. What do you make of that critique?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say is that if the dollar and all of the institutions that make the dollar work, all of the banks, all of the courts where disputes are resolved, if all of those institutions were a country, they'd definitely be in the top 5 of energy users globally. So, you know, money is expensive, quite literally, in the form of energy, because it's an important part of society. And it's very difficult to do a lot of things in society without using energy. And the global climate crisis is a very real thing that we need to, you know, take pains to address. But we need to use energy for things that are important. And frankly, I think, you know, free exchange and the movement of money across the world is one of those things that's important. And I think Bitcoin can actually do it with less energy than the current global financial system.
I mean, are there any conversations about that actively happening in the Bitcoin world about either how to make it more energy efficient or I guess there are just any adjustments that can be made in how things are processed.
So there are different methods of having consensus over the blockchain. There's proof of work and there's proof of stake. And proof of work uses the large amounts of electricity. That's things like Bitcoin. And proof of stake uses less, more like a typical data center. And those are technologies like Tezos or Cosmos and maybe Ethereum, which is transitioning from proof of work to proof of stake. But the thing about proof of stake is it's less tested than this older cryptographic technology called proof of work. And Bitcoin is supposed to be this secure asset that, you know, you don't need to trust somebody and you don't need to worry too much about the supply being corrupted or changing unexpectedly. So maybe it's worth it to run those expensive calculations that you have in proof of worth. The other thing I would say is, you know, energy is one thing. There's green energy and there's bad energy. There's coal energy and things like that that pollute and contribute to global warming. The fact of the matter is, because you can run a Bitcoin miner anywhere in the world, and electricity is your main input, you're going to locate wherever the electricity is cheapest. And often, electricity is cheapest in places where there's a low population, so not many people need electricity, but there's a lot of renewable supply, like a big dam or geothermal energy. You'd be surprised to learn that a lot of Bitcoin mining happens in Iceland, where there just aren't that many people, especially now, sadly, no one's going there as a tourist, but there's a lot of geothermal power. Now, it's true that a lot of mining is done in China as well, and some of that mining is done using coal because the Chinese government subsidizes coal miners. But that's not a Bitcoin climate problem. That's a China climate problem. They're subsidizing coal, one of the dirtiest ways of making electricity on the planet.
Well, let's take a step back, though, and just explain what Bitcoin mining means and how it relates to energy use.
Sure. So, you know, in the intro, we talked about how we've decided to use in the Bitcoin peer-to-peer money system this blockchain, this distributed ledger, as opposed to relying on one institution like a bank or, you know, a financial company to keep a ledger of transactions to solve the double spend problem. Now, the question is, how do we all, everyone on the peer-to-peer Bitcoin network, come to agree that this is the authoritative state of the network? We're not identifying each other by name. We're not, you know, no one else out there is a known commodity to anyone else. How can we trust each other? And the solution that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he, she, or they were back in 2008, came up with was, we'll have this sort of round robin tournament. Every 10 minutes or so, someone on the network will be picked to list which transactions will be included in the next block. They can't forge or mess around with the transactions. They can't redirect them to themselves, but they can choose whether or not to put the valid transactions in a block. And, you know, how do we come up with a fair method of picking who's next? Because if it was just the next IP address, you know, on the internet, a Russian scammer would just pretend to be thousands of IP addresses and spam the network. It wouldn't work. So instead, Satoshi came up with this idea that said, the next person to write a block in the blockchain will be the first person to solve a difficult math equation that anyone with a commonly available computer and some electricity is able to try and solve. And so it's kind of like a random equation. If you keep guessing a number to fill in X, eventually it'll equal Y. And the faster you can guess X, the faster you're likely to find the right answer to the math equation. But that means you'll want to compete with other miners, use more electricity to have the best chance of being the next miner to create a block. So that's proof of work. And it does involve these mathematical computations, but they're not worthless. They're a very fair way of deciding who's going to play this public role of choosing whose transactions globally get added to the next block.
Well, we got this tweet from Mark who says, again, huge amounts of energy are being expended, especially in China, mining Bitcoin. What digital currencies avoid this mining issue?
So, like I said, first of all, you know, it's only an issue if the electricity is coming from a dirty source, a place that pollutes. And so, frankly, that's a problem with Chinese energy policy where they subsidize coal, and that's the cheapest form of electricity, which draws miners to mine there rather than somewhere with cleaner energy. But, you know, to answer the question directly, Tezos, Cosmos, Polkadot, there's a number of, you know, sort of fun sounding, not Dogecoin, incidentally, but there's a number of fun sounding cryptocurrencies that are based on this new consensus mechanism, which is just a fancy word for saying we all agree on the blockchain using this mechanism. This new consensus mechanism called proof of stake, which does not involve the same amount of energy usage. But I would caution, you know, we're going to have to wait and see over the next 10, 15, 20 years even how these technologies sort of settle and which ones the market and policymakers ultimately favor. And I think, you know, we'll find out whether Bitcoin's energy usage is actually worth it because of the good it does in the world for decentralizing finance, or whether maybe we can decentralize finance using other methods like proof of stake.
What do you think would cause people to start to see Bitcoin as a better global currency than the US dollar or even gold?
Well, I think it's different. You know, better is a subjective word. I don't know if you'd want to just see better or worse, because currencies are used for different things. You know, the classical definition of money is that it does three things. It's a unit of account, like when you go to the grocery store, things are priced in this unit, like $5 for a gallon of milk. It's a store of value. It might be the way you keep your family's wealth secure. You know, you keep it in a money market account, or you keep it in cash under the mattress if you're very paranoid. Or maybe you keep it in gold or equities or commodities or any number of other investments. And then the third thing that money classically is expected to do is be a medium of exchange. It's the way I can give something of value to someone else that I know they will want. It solves the so-called double coincidence of want that is a problem with having just barter transactions all the time. Like, you want me to be on NPR and I want to give you these oranges. Maybe you don't want oranges, or I don't want to be an NPR. Oh, we could just pay each other. Not that I'm being paid for this interview, but you know,
<not. laughs>
barter doesn't work. So we want a medium of exchange, right? So those three functions of money are what we want. Now, dollars are definitely still the best way to do unit of account and medium of exchange, because they're this, you know, great global payment method. Incidentally, you can have sort of dollar-backed assets on top of Ethereum or even Bitcoin. They're called stablecoins. But the other question, the store of value question, maybe Bitcoin's great for that. And, you know, your listeners have called in and said, you know, as far as saving for college and things like that, if you bought some 4 or 5 years ago, it's been a pretty good deal as a store of value, an extraordinarily good deal, actually. Now, that's not guaranteed to continue. And you should always, you know, you should never invest more than you'd be willing to lose, as with any speculative investment. But frankly, I think Bitcoin's already vastly superior to gold. I mean, gold is what? It's a yellow rock, and there's only so much of it. So that's a scarce supply, demand shifts, you have a positive price. Well, Bitcoin is also very similar to gold, scarce supply, demand shifts, and you get a positive price. But unlike gold, it's got a teleporter attached to it. I could send it to somebody in Singapore right now, and they could send it back to me, and it would all happen within an hour. Good luck with a bar of gold.
We got this email from Stephanie, who asks, I was recently at a 7-Eleven and noticed they have a Bitcoin ATM next to the regular ATM. Go figure. I wondered, if I put in a $20 bill, will I get $20 worth of Bitcoin? Peter?
Yeah, I mean, you got to trust the person who's operating the ATM. So it's important to note that the Bitcoin blockchain is the part that's decentralized, where we use strong encryption and mathematical technologies that have been developed as early as the 1960s and 70s, rather than trusting, you know, a person. We trust math. But when you're buying Bitcoin, you're going to be trusting the person who's selling it to you. And so there is a person operating that Bitcoin ATM, and you have to trust them that the machine's not just going to eat your $20 bill and not give you the Bitcoin. That said, in the US at least, these Bitcoin ATM operators are regulated, as I said earlier, as state money transmission licensees. And that means they had to post a bond. So if, you know, they do something malfeasant, they'll lose a bunch of money that they're bonded with by the state.
Colby tweets, Bitcoin gives me a sense of security and allows me to act as my own bank. And Janelle emailed us this, with a bank, my money is insured by the FDIC. Should something happen to the bank, what insurance does Bitcoin offer? Can you explain a little bit more about that, Peter?
Yeah. So again, it's important to first point out that there's two ways to hold Bitcoin. Now, you can hold your own Bitcoin, and then it's kind of like you're securing your money by keeping a password. You know, keeping a password safe. And we hear these stories of people who lost a hard drive, it got buried in a landfill somewhere, mm-hmm. and they realized that they kept their Bitcoin password, the private key it's called, on that hard drive. And if it's enough Bitcoin, some of these people are thinking of digging up entire landfills because there's a hard drive from 2000 and 2011 somewhere amongst all of the decaying garbage. So, you know, you don't have any recourse if you're holding your own Bitcoin. It's kind of like having $1,000 in cash in your wallet or under the mattress. If your house burns down or you lose your wallet, you've lost your money. Now, that's bad for people who are worried about losing their wallet, but it's actually good for people who are in parts of the world where they don't have someone else to hold their valuables for them because they don't have a good rule of law in their country. They don't have reputable financial institutions in their country. For somebody in those parts of the world, it might be better for them to actually secure it themselves and not have to worry about trusting a financial institution. Now, it's true in the U.S., our financial institutions are insured by the U.S. government. Now, your Bitcoin balances at financial institutions, if you were to have someone hold your Bitcoin for you rather than hold it yourself, they're not FDIC insured. Important to point that out. But as I said, these financial institutions are still regulated. They're regulated as state money transmitters. So your Bitcoin balances are about as safe as your balances at, say, a PayPal or a MoneyGram or a Western Union. Now, maybe we want federal regulation instead of state regulation, maybe we'd be more comfortable with that. And frankly, that's a reasonable proposal. It would mean the federal government would have to come up with a, money transmission licensing regime that is an alternative to state money transmission licensing, which could be a political big lift. You'd have to have legislation from Congress, which, no one should ever hold their breath for, unfortunately, these days. But it's on the table. And, sensible policymakers in D.C. are discussing it.
Well, we got this tweet from someone who says, cryptocurrency initially allowed people from a range of economic backgrounds to participate. Can it remain that way, or will banks and large corporations simply price out access for average or lower income Americans? How can people with fewer resources maintain their participation?
So you can't really be priced out in this system. It's fundamentally different. The thing about bank money and electronic payments that aren't cryptocurrencies, the old-fashioned electronic payments like PayPal and MoneyGram, is you have no alternative. You have to use a trusted institution, and they have to be willing to open an account for you. And the sad fact of the matter is that they only open accounts for people they think they'll make money off of. And that's why we have a huge underbanked problem in the U.S., an unbanked problem globally. Like, lots of people just can't convince a bank to open an account for them. With Bitcoin, if you're willing to hold it yourself, and a lot of people are, and it can be fairly easy to do too, as long as you're careful and the software that you're using is good and guides you through the process of securing your password. The thing about that is it doesn't matter who you are. If you have an internet connection, maybe you use public Wi-Fi even at a library, and you have a smartphone, which is not cheap, but they're certainly more available than they used to be, then you can access the Bitcoin network. Then you can create a Bitcoin address and someone can pay you at that address. So the barriers to entry are much, much lower, and they have more to do with just being able to get technology in your hands than convince some soulless banker somewhere that that they should open an account for you.
Well, Peter, I'm curious what you're watching for. We know Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen isn't a huge fan of Bitcoin. She's called it highly speculative and extremely inefficient. What will you be watching for in the, I guess, months and years to come around cryptocurrencies?
Sure. One of your listeners called in and said that it was a huge tax headache. And, I really feel for that person. I've suffered a little of these tax headaches myself, although, frankly, I wish I bought more when I got this job originally. But tax policy could be so much better. And it's not that people are trying to evade taxes with Bitcoin. It's just that the IRS hasn't been clear about how you're supposed to calculate your capital gains using this thing. And if they can develop some clarity, they'll just get more revenue, which is good for them. And ordinary Americans won't have to suffer every April trying to figure out how to calculate basis on their Dogecoin. And that would be better.
That's Peter Van Valkenburg, Director of Research at Coin Center. That's a think tank that studies cryptocurrencies. Peter, thanks for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Jen.
Today's producer was James Morrison. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.